Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource graciously supported through contributions by our listeners. To find out more about our program and how you can help, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com or stick around to the end for more information. Now, on with the show. Welcome to episode 121, where we are examining Mark Zebrocki's article, The Rhetoric and Reality of Total Quality Management, published in Administrative Science Quarterly in 1998. To learn more about the text, please go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com.
Hello, everyone. This is Greta calling in from Dordrecht.
Hi, this is Rohan calling in from London.
And this is Tom calling from Carlisle, Pennsylvania in the United States. Welcome, everyone. And we have a very, very interesting article that is considered one of the classics and is also a frequent appearer on various syllabi. It is Mark Zebrocki's The Rhetoric and Reality of Total Quality Management, published in the Administrative Science Quarterly back in 1998. And it talks about what was total quality management and its appearance and how it, on the one hand, was a very well-thought, well-theorized process and culture for improving the performance of organizations. But the reality, as expressed in the title of the article, diverged. And how it diverged is the subject of Mark's article. What that means for other, shall we say, new great ideas either become adopted or become just dismissed as some sort of a fad. So we decided that perhaps the best thing to do is to actually talk a little bit about total quality management before getting into the article, because this was a thing about 30 some odd years ago, actually more like 40 or 50, because its seminal ideas came in the late 60s, early 1970s. And you might say that this is an example of an attempt to systematize and, quantify everything. The idea was that if you had good, solid data about your performance metrics, there are things that you can do to increase performance according to the against those metrics. And it's not just a matter of making the machines turn faster. This is a matter of work culture and attitudes towards work. So it would be a total organizational look. Now, I'm going to go ahead and read from one of the texts that I happen to have possession of, which is a book by Marshall Sashkin and Kenneth Kaiser called Total Quality Management. And this was published in 1992. And this is an example of the kind of book that might be sold in a management bookstore or a management aisle of a bookstore, where you as a manager might walk in, pay a couple of dollars or a couple of euros, get this book, and in very simple practitioner-oriented language, we'll probably figure out what it is we're going to do about it. I'm going to read just a section of the first page, What is Total Quality Management? The aim in this chapter is to arrive at a common understanding of TQM, and we're going to use that acronym quite a bit. Okay. It all started with a Japanese import, in quotes, called quality circles, and we will refer to these as QCs. Quality control circles. The idea is to have workers meet occasionally for about an hour or so each week to discuss work problems. As a result of their discussion, the workers develop ideas about how to solve the problems they've identified. This chapter goes on to talk about how these ideas of the quality control circles became very popular, spread around all over the place, came to the United States. And it says here, by 1986, quality control circles were so common that Business Week, a publication, included them as a fad of the 1980s. So not every quality control installation was a grand success. And then it goes into a real-life case of where there were mixed results. TQM is geared to try to do that same kind of a thing, except for in a better fashion. And it begins to get into the history of some of its initial proponents, Dr. Deming, who began his career as an industrial engineer investigating problems of quality control. He worked at the Hawthorne plant, and we just did an episode on the Hawthorne studies not too long ago. So they go over that, and they present the control charts that Deming devised in the late 1960s that kind of shows performance by sample, of which then the idea is that this provides the metric by which you measure performance, and then how do you tackle the problem of quality controls that that particular chart exhibits. So you put this all together, and the emphasis in this is that it's okay to quantify stuff, but if you don't address the culture, if you don't address the ordinary means by which workers can have a voice in identifying and promoting the fixes to problems, the problems will perpetuate, your quality goes down, you know, problems happen, et cetera, et cetera. So total quality management has conceived not just a matter of coming up with the metrics, but operationalizing them in the way that workers engage with the work. Hopefully that kind of sets the stage for then the discussion that Mark gets into as to how TQM began to spread from this really, really good idea to what was actually implemented.
Yeah, and I guess just thanks for that panoptic view, Tom, because I think, like you said, TQM we're going to keep mentioning a lot, but it's important to know what was going on in the times when this paper was written and why it was such an important topic. As part of this came out of Mark's dissertation work. And to position the paper a bit, actually, I had come across an interview that Mark did for the ASQ blog where he talks about where this idea came from and how it was part of his dissertation work. And he talks about how he actually used to work in IBM, and he was an industrial engineer by training before moving to Stanford for his PhD. And that drove some of his interest in looking at these processes from both this kind of technical and institutional standpoint. Just to quote a little bit from that interview, he says, essentially, when he went to Stanford and there, you know, people were talking a lot about the Mayer and Rowan paper on institutional kind of conformity, myth and ceremony, and the DiMaggio and Powell paper, which is a recent episode of ours as well, on kind of isomorphism. Mark says, and I quote, "There was a great deal made of the distinction between technical settings and institutional settings, suggesting that in technical settings, one would expect less ceremonial conformity compared to institutional settings. I kept looking at it and saying, no, this is not right as a formulation, because my work experience at IBM suggests, which is a seriously competitive context, I saw what looked like a version of ceremonial conformity." So it came from his background being in a technical setting, but still seeing some of these institutional dynamics at play and being an industrial engineer who understood the phenomenon of TQM quite well, drove him to kind of investigate this for his dissertation. Now, the paper, which came out in ASQ in 1998, sets itself very much in this intersection of kind of, or let's say with this backdrop of institutional theory, and looking at, let's say, institutional theory tells us about how there can be this decoupling between what people say and what people do. And this paper is interested into getting into the process of how that happens over time. So what he calls the accretion process of over time of TQM in practice, which then led to this study, which is a kind of a comparative case study. So the classic Eisenhart 1989 style methodology. In this case, he looks at five different settings, and we can go into them in a little bit. But he frames the paper in a way that I found quite compelling. And of course, as we know, with a lot of qual work, the framing takes time to percolate. But he talks about how TQM is surrounded by what he calls an ironic controversy. The reason it's controversial is just because there are proponents of it who think that it's brilliant, and there are opponents of it who think that it's total hogwash. But the reason it's ironic is because a lot of the opponents who think it's hogwash actually are academics who've contributed to the original, the studies and the statistical methods and understandings that comprise TQM. So they do believe in the fundamentals of it, but they still oppose TQM as a overall program. So it's interesting to then examine what's this difference between the proponents and opponents, and why are the people who have studied it and who like a lot of the underlying components still dislike TQM as a whole. And kind of like, I guess a hint to the answer is the fact that there are different versions of TQM. And so the proponents might be in favor of a certain version. The opponents might be knocking down a different version from what the proponents are perhaps putting across.
And this paper also was awarded widely for its contributions to institutional theory, and I think organizational theory more broadly. And I really like, Rowan, how you pointed out that this was a dissertation research of Mark, and he was embedded at Stanford. And we also know that the origins of institutional theory, how it has been developing in the organizational field, originate from that university. Woody Powell was there. You know, he wrote around that time on the institutional isomorphism. What Mark also says in his paper, like the role of legitimacy and rhetoric as a symbolic way to gain legitimacy in a market by customers, by your suppliers, was really prominent there. And that is where his contribution lies in showing the dialectics there. And I think, you know, we have different papers that use this dialectical theorizing, but I think this is a brilliant paper showing how over time rhetoric and reality play a role, and that there's a dialectic relation between them. It's not just rhetoric, it's not just reality. Too much rhetoric can generate counter rhetorics. In the case of TQM, that the people that are most ambitious in pursuing it get disillusioned and then create sarcasm about the method. But also you need to have rhetoric to inspire people to actually take this management practice or management innovation seriously and develop programs. So it's not either or, it's both. And I think that is beautifully documented in his process model, or he calls it an evolutionary model. And I think another point that I was reflecting on, and perhaps we can come back to it in part two, is how TQM, its origin started off in the US. Then it moved post-World War II to Japan. There it really got embedded in certain organizations. And Mark cites the work of Tachiki in 1992. I think he was at an important bank in Japan where he implemented TQM. We can check the references. I don't have it at hand so quickly. But then it was brought back to the US. And perhaps that idea that you can move and implement best practices is also something that Mark debunked with this paper.
Yeah, thanks. And yeah, that was another very fascinating bit, because we did have in conference episode a discussion about how ideas morph as they go across boundaries. And so then what gets implemented in one place is very different than what gets implemented in another. And that sort of contributes to this rhetoric reality divide. I think we can just dive into the meaning of those terms, because I think they're kind of important, because rhetoric and reality, although they sound intuitive, there's a natural definition. It's probably good to quote what Mark is referring to. Page 605, I have defined rhetoric as the manager's stated claims and accounts of TQM use, especially in the context of ongoing organizational life. And I have defined reality as the specific elements of TQM in practice and discourse, but I ground that reality in a set of specific technical practices. So the important thing here is that, you know, rhetoric and reality, he even said above, it reflects a difference between what people say and what people do. But the article, you know, the study itself is very, very focused on specific subset of the rhetoric and the specific subset of the reality. And I think that that's going to be important, because I would have taken a perhaps a more expansive view of rhetoric, but we can get into that after we discuss the story as a whole.
Yeah, I think following on precisely from what you were saying, Tom, part of this, his definition of rhetoric and reality is narrow because of the way we write our academic papers, where you need this kind of cohesive linkage. And so when he talks about his methods, for example, he interviewed a lot of people and gathered materials from five different sites. But because he's defined rhetoric and reality in a tractable manner, he's able to partition his data accordingly as well. So from the same interviews, for example, He can identify which parts are rhetoric, which is the claims that people are making, versus which parts are reality, which is when they talk about what tools they're actually using in the organization, what templates they might be using, what practices they might be following. And so, of course, I don't know for a fact which came first, the definition or the data partitioning, but it's highly possible that the definition was kind of articulated in a way that makes it link up well with the methods of this paper as well. Just a quick overview, I suppose, on the actual sites themselves so that the listener can have a more clear picture of the kinds of the variety of cases studied. He studies five different settings or research sites. One is a defense contractor, one is a government agency, and then he looks at a hospital, a hotel, and a manufacturing firm. So it's quite diverse. We might think about it more traditionally in settings like manufacturing or defense contractor, but he also covers quite a range of settings. And in each of them, he kind of talks to people, collects documents, and gets a sense of what was the rhetoric and reality of TQM in each of these settings. And I think his method is what ultimately contributes to what Greta was talking about, which is the wonderful complexity of the whole story, the fact that he's able to add so much more richness to the more basic institutional theory ideas of decoupling or conformity is because he studied so many different settings and how things are slightly different in almost each of those settings.
I totally agree. And I think for the doctoral students, this paper might be a very good example of the multiple case study method. And another person that already was teaching at Stanford at the time, I believe, was Kathy Eisenhardt, who led the foundations of multiple case study research. And you see the influence of her methodology in this paper where, Mark, you know, the paper focuses on five settings, but he did preliminary interviews at four other organizations, which helped him refine his interview protocol, the way he could study his phenomenon he mentions in his method section. But then he narrowed it down to five. And instead of focusing on five companies that are exactly the same or completely comparable, which a lot of studies, you know, claim to be, and then have like different findings that can be explained by one variable along which they differ, this is a great example of having vastly different empirical settings and then focusing on the commonalities. What is happening in similar ways across these vastly different settings. And so it offers a foundation to generalize a little bit further beyond your specific setting, I think. So just wanted to highlight that as well.
I'd also like to highlight that it isn't just a matter of the five settings being different in terms of the type of organization, public, private, or what have you, but also different reasons for implementing TQM, different understandings of the validity or the he calls it external TQM program reputation. That is what the organizations themselves understood about TQM before adopting it. There was a diversity of perspectives or orientations toward TQM among these five cases, which also, I think, added to the richness. So there really wasn't a lot that was in common among these five organizations.
Yeah, and then adding to the analytical complexity, like analyzing this data set must have been a hell of a job, because he also interviewed people from as close to the CEO level to the shop floor and interviewing people that were involved in TQM programs, but also talking to people that were not involved in them. And they all had such varied perspectives. So to make sense of this huge data set and come up with this model that he developed, that must have been a huge task.
So just to maybe put some dimensions around this huge thing, as he does in the paper, of course, we can think of it as there's the one dimension he's interested in, which is rhetoric and reality. Then there's a process view that he's interested in, which is starting from when TQM comes into the organization because managers or experts have heard about it from the outside world, to when they are implementing TQM, so employees are getting exposed to different programs, etc., to the end where they are now talking about it back to the outside world or back to themselves and telling stories about it. So there's the rhetoric reality, there's the process view of it, and then there's a third dimension which he adds as part of his findings, which is the more evolutionary theoretical dimension of, you know, the classic VSR, variation, selection, retention, showing how within each stage of the process and within nested layers of the organization, from the large organization down to the individual and to teams. There's variation at every step of what people are saying and hearing and doing, of rhetoric and reality. There's selection of rhetoric and reality. There's retention of rhetoric and reality over time. And again, creating this very kind of complex process view of what's going on.
Right. So trying to picture this is, so you've got the VSR as your top level, and there's a VSR cycle at each one of those steps. A variation has its own VSR cycle, outputs leading to the selection process. And that was fascinating because I'm accustomed more to seeing evolutionary models in terms of, say, seeing how different parts of an organization or different organizations or different settings all are trying to change in the same direction and good ideas bubble up to the surface. This was used in a different way than I was accustomed of looking at it as a series of stages ongoing within each of these five cases, and therefore producing some very interesting findings about what got retained and why.
Before we dive into the findings, shall we talk a bit about like what, you know, he talks a lot about the theoretical base about of TQM and how that provided the foundation to study the reality of TQM. And he's specifically talking about certain techniques that are part of the TQM practice. Like he mentions like a statistical process control, assorted data analysis, flow charts, ID generation tools like brainstorming. And he actually, at the end of the paper, he makes a claim that technical base is very important in studying the reality. And these were these tools, he says, quoting that Japanese guy again, Tachiki, have been an important part of TQM from its earliest application. So that's where he started off actually looking at in his interviews, in his observations, in his archival analysis, do they actually use the tools that are part of the TQM method?
Yeah, and I think because what that does, and that raises interesting questions about what we would expect in other settings, but what it does, having that technical reality base, is it, even if the practices diffuse, which is what he studies, they still diffuse around a core. And so he talks about how some of those tools, I think there were seven such tools that he still observes in all of his settings, all of his research sites. If you compare that to something like, for example, back when I was in consulting, digital transformation was the word of the day. All the projects were about digital transformation, helping companies with that. That doesn't have as much of a reality base to it to begin with. So there will still be realities in organizations and those kinds of management fashions or practices. But there you could imagine the whole thing shifts over time. Even if it diffuses, it just diffuses into something entirely different, maybe over the course of 5-10 years. Versus something like TQM can still have the core reality that it was built on to begin with, which is interesting, of course.
Okay. Are we ready to go into like each of the three phases and discuss what his findings were? So then in the bulk of the middle of the paper, he then goes across the evolutionary model and presents first the variation. Well, how is it going to understand the problem that it faces and what is it's going to be its approach? And he did this for all three phases. He presented the rhetoric and the reality diagrammatically, showing how, you know, what is going on in the rhetoric side and the reality side across the variation, selection, and retention within the variation overall cycle. I thought the diagrams were a little bit difficult to interpret sometimes, but I think it's intended to convey a very simple story. In the variation cycle, this is what you would just ordinarily expect. Managers rhetorically are trying to understand and make sense of the problems that they have with performance. Therefore, they gather information, look for opportunities, look for options, and then choose one. Okay, that's your retention. And the retention output is we will implement TQM. The drivers of that come, of course, from reality, because you do have competition and others' performance. That's kind of part of the reality. You have consumer demands that are part of the reality. But ultimately, it gets filtered through the managerial lens as to how do they perceive the situation, therefore driving the need to implement something. The part I wasn't too clear on was you know, the reality side of it, once it gets into this managerial side of things, it's just, as I read this, it's just business as usual because the organization itself hasn't implemented anything yet. So it's just titled it as ongoing work. That's at least how I interpreted it.
Yeah, me too. And also to show that the conversation about TQM was pure rhetoric and it wasn't embedded yet in deeper into the organization. That's how I understood the model there.
Yeah, I think a kind of shorthand that helps me to make sense. I agree with you, Tom, that they are a little bit abstruse to the reader, at least to kind of the first few reads, one or two reads of the paper. What helps me to understand it, and I don't think this little hack that I'm about to say goes away from the true intent of these figures, is that although it's presented as figure one variation within that VSR, figure two selection within that VSR, figure three retention, you can also think of those first figures as following that temporal dimension of the process. So figure one is just TQM coming into the organization within that VSR. Figure two is TQM being implemented in the organization within that VSR. Figure three is TQM being, you know, appraised and retained in the organization within that VSR. And so if we take that, like think of it temporally, then the first figure is about TQM coming in, which is why when he talks about variation, selection, retention, it's more around the rhetoric. They're deciding on whether or not to implement it. But in terms of reality, there is no TQM reality in the organization at this point because it's kind of T0 at this stage and in this figure.
Yeah, thanks, Rowan. And that really clarifies then when you go to figure two and you can start to see now, once the decision is made, how does it affect the reality? What actually happens? And what's reflected there is that, okay, now we start with implementing training, you know, trying to put it into practice by taking parts of the organization. And he shows this as nested boxes. So you've got the bigger box on the reality side reflects the overall organization that's still chumming along, but you've got inside of it these processes of trying to indoctrinate, socialize TQM, but also the emergence of, oh dear, this isn't going to work here exactly as the book says, we've got to adopt. What happens is then teams get together, try to discuss, okay, how are we going to adopt this or what have you, so that it can work in our organization. And then that goes back up to the rhetoric side because that gets bubbled up to the managers and say, okay, we'd like to make a change in the implementation. This is what we're proposing. And now management has got to make a decision as to whether or not to adopt the proposal. Meanwhile, the diagram also shows that while this socialization is happening, management is already making the grand pronouncements, the ribbon cutting, the all hands meeting, messages to stakeholders or stockholders or whoever saying, we're doing TQM. And found it interesting that that box just ended there. There wasn't an arrow coming out of it. So that's sort of like how where you start to really see the rhetoric and the reality potentially being divergent, because now managers are talking, but the organization has only begun doing, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And I think the divergence continues into the, you know, figure three and stage three of the process, which is where you go from the feedback, let's say, that you're getting from now that you've started implementing it to iterating on that. So now the variation is the solutions on these kind of on the problems that came up when you were implementing TQM and the feedback that you got. And you move towards then now telling success stories about what works or why TQM is so successful, etc. And what's interesting here, one thing that's interesting across both diagrams, all three diagrams, is that the ongoing work box continues. I wouldn't say it's interesting, it's a given, but it's good that he's made it explicit so that you understand that the kind of business as usual is still happening regardless of how the TQM practice is varying. But what's interesting in this stage is that idea of selective storytelling. So it's only the successes that get told and the failures, you know, in the beginning of the paper, he talks about how often these things did fail, but what they would glorify or valorize in the organization is the successes. And now, so hence you have a divergence now in the rhetoric side of it away from perhaps what the reality is within the organization. Of course, at that stage, it's also a little bit different. If I was a stickler for evolutionary theories in the Darwinian sense, then you're technically speaking, your variation is supposed to be random variation, which it's not in this case. And the selection is supposed to be based on fitness, just what fits the function. But here you see a lot more of kind of the human side of it, or almost the perhaps political side of it, where the selection is not based on fitness or function. It's based on what makes you look good in the case of selective storytelling.
I guess also here the outside world comes in inside again, just as where it played a role in TQM entering the organization. This is where TQM exits the organization, and you cannot really make a good name by sharing your failure stories. So that's where the success stories come into play. But actually, I wanted to highlight, you know, a few interesting things for each phase of the model, if I may. And the first thing that related to phase one, where, you know, TQM as a management innovation or management practice comes into the organization, you see like CEOs and top managers first being very skeptical about it. Like, is this something we need to adopt? And what I found interesting is that instead of looking what it actually entails, they only look at the success stories of other organizations and if it as a management practice might offer a solution to the problems that they face. So then when they move into phase two, when they say, okay, we will implement, these people, the same people that were first critical of the method, now have to sell it internally without actually knowing what the method is about. And that brings me to point two, that then Mark talks about the role of ignorance and intimidation, shaping the rhetoric and reality of TQM in phase two, where they actually start to implement. And ignorance is that they actually don't know what they're selling. So it's very hard for them. And especially when they then bring external, you know, consultants into the organization to help form these teams and help to train them, but also intimidation by its technical component, which I believe in four of the five cases led to the organization neglecting most of the technical components. I think it was only the manufacturing firm that did adopt some of the technical components of TQM. And it's also funny that in a little note later in the paper, he writes like, you know, this case adopted most of the technical aspects of TQM, but the CEO also then left the company to become a TQM consultant later on. Funny side note. But there you see, like, when managers don't really know what they're trying to sell and implement, and then don't have the technological expertise to understand its core aspects, it really shapes the way it gets implemented. And then in the last part, I found it really striking in the model, and I'm not sure how much attention is given in the findings itself, but really the importance of the workers that got trained in TQM, that were part of these teams, problem-solving teams, in successfully implementing solutions. But they often also got disillusioned by management when little change happened after going through the TQM process. So they came up with solutions to important problems. Their success stories got written up and shared and then moved up the hierarchy into the management layers. But in actual reality, in their ongoing work, they saw little change and that demotivated them. He spends a little bit of time in the findings about that, but that was something that I found striking in terms of phase three of the model.
Yeah, if I was going to offer sort of a critique about the diagrams, in addition to what I had said previously, is that I think it would have been helpful to have understood what was meant by TQM problems. For example, because there's like whole different classes of problems that ensued. And among them, the one that I highlighted the most, because this is one thing that I have seen. This is page 619. Employees wondered why they had to use the TQM process while their managers apparently didn't. Problems, you know, the way that when you look at the box in the diagram and you see problems, well, you know, you're probably going to first think about imperfect implementation, but it went far beyond imperfect implementation. There were technical issues that surfaced that required addressing. There were social concerns. You're highlighting where there's do as I say, not as I do, sort of an attitude. which poisoned the well, if you will, that no rhetoric was going to ultimately overcome. And that, unfortunately, I don't think the way that this paper presented it did enough in my mind to really highlight the differences between the technical and the social failures. And then when it came back up to the rhetoric side, you get a sense of the technical failures, but the social failures, those bad news stories contaminated the reality as well, I'm sure.
Yeah, definitely. And also, you know, what Mark writes, that the people on the shop floor or on the work floor that are most excited about, you know, implementing TQM got the most disillusioned in the end. And that led to those counter rhetorics coming into play.
Yeah, and I guess in the spirit of critique, the other thing perhaps missing, although there's only so much you can do, of course, in the journal article format, but with this wide variety of cases, it would have been interesting to see more contingent variation as well, where based on, for example, the nature of work in hospitality versus defense contracting versus manufacturing versus healthcare, does that affect the rhetoric and reality process as a whole, or the level of divergence between it? Does the reality shine through a bit more strongly in certain, maybe in manufacturing, just to kind of speculate? Or do you see equal amounts of kind of how much the social influences the technical and vice versa? I would have loved to see a bit more on that as well. So kind of bringing, making it contingent on, which comes back to your point, Tom, where the social part, although he does talk about how this social construction, in fact, towards his discussion, he says on page 630, the social construction of TQM is not simply a symbolic process. And he talks about how it has very significant consequences for the technical side of it. But it would have been richer to see how it's happening in those settings and how it differs in different settings.
Yeah, now we should close the model too, because they're right around 630, 631, and also following the retention phase is the return phase. And this is where the cycle begins again. So now that the organization has gone through this implementation, now it's essentially back to where it started, if you will, where the success stories may be spreading, the failures are being, he says, retained inside the organization. The problems, the original problems, are still kind of there. And now it's sort of like we start the process all over again, which perhaps you might interpret as an organization that has gone through this and realized that TQM is just not the thing for it. Now it's going through the process of trying to figure out, okay, what should we do instead? Do we go balance scorecard, or do we do something else? Or do we continue to invest efforts into TQM? Or do we just divest ourselves of this whole mess and pretend it didn't happen? That kind of closes the model, which I think is really helpful, because, you know, obviously with evolutionary change, you're thinking of feedback. You're thinking of a constant cycle of change and decisions ongoing. And he captured that.
Yeah. And I think if you think about the phenomenon again, the model closes within, let's say, the domain of TQM. But if you put this in the context of other research happening at the time, specifically, you know, Eric Abrahamson's work on fads and fashions in management, you can see how at some point the loop starts just moving away from TQM altogether to whatever is the next management practice that comes into vogue or into the discourse, which then within that practice, you might see the same cycle again play out. So it's interesting to place this within that broader conversation that was happening a lot within the scholarly community in the 90s about fads and fashions in management practice.
Yeah, I guess this coincided also with the rise of organizational culture. That was kind of the same period, right? Post-World War II. Maybe that was a little bit earlier, like 60s in Japan, and it was like the 90s that it moved over to the US. Yeah, but here it was just a practice, then maybe they focused on the culture. Like what Mark points out in the paper, actually, is the role of employee turnover. And it's very hard to sustain TQM in an organization when the people leave the organization, when there are no funds to continue training new employees into the practice. And I guess it also shows, like, you know, I think we had an episode on organizational learning. Yeah, like you need to invest in a culture to socialize people in the way you do work in an organization. In the beginning of the paper, like some of the people that worked in the hotel, they mentioned that they got the training, I believe, in how they would do TQM in the hotel, but they said, you know, we're just cleaning rooms and doing plumbing. So what we have to do for TQM is so far removed from our everyday work. And yeah, when you have new employees, then it just becomes forgotten, I guess. And that's also what part of the contribution of Mark's work is to the conversation on institutionalized practices, is that when they would only have been adopted symbolically, it would be a very rigid set of practices that they would claim to use or would use in to some extent. But what he sees is, as over time, these organizations vary vastly in what practices they claim to be part of TQM, and that it's not a standardized package at all. So I found that a very insightful comment. And he then says, like that, then in the end, when people get disillusioned, when it diffuses as a practice, then it goes into decay. Could we say that? I don't know where the next management fashion comes, pops up.
Yeah, I think it also brings up what it was about the organizational theorists who were proponents of the foundational technical ideas, who opposed TQM as a thing. Suffice to say that this is an area where, with exploring the gap between theory and practice, and I'm sure a lot of us have seen the Lewin quote in several articles saying that there's nothing more practical than a good theory. But theory and practice really is different. And just because you have a good theory doesn't mean it just poofs right into practice. And I think that it's worth exploring, why did the theorists think that that was not a good idea?
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of their respective organizations or institutions. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. If so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch with us via LinkedIn, Facebook, X, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Also, please consider contributing to the program by buying us a coffee at www.buyusacoffee.com/TAOP. That's www.buyusacoffee.com/TAOP. Your support is greatly appreciated, as it allows us to continue providing great conversations about the classics of organization studies. Again, thank you for listening, and we hope to see you for the conclusion of this episode here on Talking About Organizations.